Richard Tarnas, welcome to the program. So nice to have you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You were born in Switzerland and spent time at Big Sur. Gee, you've been in some beautiful places.
Those are both beautiful places. Big Sur, I particularly was in my adult years, so I have much better now memory of it, and it's really one of the most beautiful places in the world.
It is. It's one of the prettiest places on the face of the globe. My God, it's beautiful. Anyway, it's good to have you. And I think I want to ask you what do you think? Can you define or attempt to define consciousness?
Well, you don't start off with very difficult questions, do you?
No, I don't. You'll have to put up with me. I'm pretty directed when I'm interested in something, and you know, I read this, and it says study of consciousness, and so it's a damn good question, and I know it's probably not answerable, so just, you know, do the best you can.
Well, I think first of all, if consciousness is a mystery, it's something that we all are experience in our every moment. It's the what we're embedded in a sense, nothing that we believe exists outside of the medium. Everything that we experience is experienced through the medium of consciousness. So it,
you bet.
It's a kind of oceanic realm that we're just immersed in all the time. It's kind of like consciousness is we're the fish in the ocean, in the same sense that human beings are in consciousness.
I have five cats, kitty cats. Are they conscious?
I believe so.
I also believe so.
I think the conviction that cats or whales are not conscious are in some sense, you know, mechanistic, unconscious automata is, I think, a very temporary and local prejudice that, you know, came up in the modern period, and it's completely unshared by any society outside of this one. And I think it could only be maintained, that conviction could only be maintained by really narrowing our consciousness, in a sense, to believe that. And
well,
I think the people, well, just to finish, a lot of the, I think, cutting-edge research that's happening right now in the animal behavior, for example,
yes,
where people are really spending very long amounts of time in an extremely patient attitude and in interaction with various species, I think, are just finding... They're uncovering many more signs of emotion and of purpose and all the categories that we associate with human consciousness in some form.
Okay, a lot of people say that human consciousness is all there is. That only an awareness of self is real consciousness, and that's why they ascribe it just to human beings and rule out everything else that walks around on two or four, whatever.
Yes, and I mean that it seems implausible to me, and I think the people that I are spending the most amount of time with the least prejudice and the most, you know, to use the phrase that Barbara McClintock, the Nobel Prize winning scientist, said, you have to have a feeling for the organism in order to understand it. You have to have she was working not with animal species, but at a much finer level of biological studies. But it was, even she recognized that you have to overcome a kind of barrier between the subject and the object. You have to enter into the reality of what you're studying.
Yeah, you said a mouthful there. Once you get to know the organism, the cat in question, for example.
Yep.
I just used that. There's no question in my mind, Richard, none whatsoever. Those creatures are as conscious as I am. And so, therefore, I believe that consciousness is widespread. I think that it may turn out to be one of the greatest powers on the face of the earth, particularly directed consciousness. And we talked a little bit before the program. You weren't all that familiar with the Princeton work, but I think you know enough about it now. And it sounded like a bell went on, like you'd done some research in this area before and heard about it. So what's going on there is just incredibly exciting, Richard. Very exciting.
It seems to me so. Much more about it than I do. But from what I've heard, it seems to me to be one of the ways in which researchers are uncovering signs of a kind of
force.
A force field, in a sense.
Yes.
That all human beings, and probably more than human beings, participate in.
Well, I just have this feeling it's going to lead down a whole new road. As we discovered nuclear energy, we're kind of beginning to discover consciousness now. It may be some years before it really comes into vogue, but there's something really big going on there. And so I guess I'll end it there, but I did want to press you a little bit on it. Let's move on to your books and what you really want to talk about, and what is it you really want to know? What are the arguments made in your books? And let's review what we've got here. Cosmos and Psyche, Limitations of a New Worldview, and The Passion of the Western Mind, Understanding the Ideas that Have Shaped Our Worldview. Both very interesting subjects.
Well, The Passion of the Western Mind was a book that I wrote actually while I was in Big Sur in the 1980s, and that book set out a history of the Western worldview from the ancient Greeks to the postmodern. I wanted to basically give as clear a narrative history as possible about what went into shaping the assumptions with which we currently view the world, and in a sense tell the drama of it. It's a kind of epic drama.
All right, give me an idea. What does go into shaping all that we are now? What are the main things?
Well, an enormous factor, for example, was the Copernican Revolution, which in a sense everything led to it. Greek philosophy, the medieval scholastics, the Renaissance intellectual atmosphere, all these set into this extremely powerful moment of transformation that Copernicus and then Kepler, Galileo, and then finally Newton kind of climaxed it. In that period, we basically went through the destruction of the cosmology that virtually every other society prior to our own lived within, namely the belief that we are on a stable, centered, fixed Earth, and that this is the center of the cosmos. And suddenly, the Earth is a planet, and it's a totally different universe, because not only is the Earth moving, but the entire view of the cosmos as embedded with meaning and purpose, that somehow human beings could know, understand, participate in, that was radically transformed to a new universe, which eventually brought forth the idea that the universe has no intrinsic meaning or purpose. It's a random mechanistic phenomenon, and human beings are a kind of isolated oddity of consciousness. And to continue the theme that you began our conversation with, the outcome of the Copernican and then the scientific revolution, more generally, is a worldview in which human consciousness experiences itself as being so singular, so unusual, such a kind of random accident that has popped up in a world that is seen as being intrinsically unconscious and purposeless and impersonal. So that's the, we all grow up, we all in the, growing up in the 20th century with our modern education, we all grew up within a universe in which our deepest psychological and spiritual aspirations and needs and so forth were viewed as taking place inside a cosmic container that was entirely indifferent to those aspirations. And this is a that's the basis of the whole, you know, existentialist crisis of the modern period.
Are we ruled by planets, by the sun, by those masses that circle with us and about us and around us? In other words, we're headed down this astrological road, I guess, astrology, it mentions here. So that's a straight-on question. Are we ruled by these bodies? Is there really something to astrology? There certainly seems to be, at some level. There seems to be. So, and many people are devoted to it as giving the answers to, you know, life, important life questions, where certain planets are at certain times in the sun. Are we ruled by those things?
I think that's probably too cut and dry or simple a question to give a cut and dry, simple answer, but I could give a response that reflects more the.
Are they big influences?
Yes, I think that the planets and the sun and moon and their movements seem to, in their alignments, coincide in a meaningful way with the experiences of individuals as well as collective humanity. And this is a conclusion I came to after. I've now been studying this for 30 years, and it was an astonishing, for me, perspective to enter into, because I was convinced, as I think virtually anybody is with a 20th century education, that astrology is the most
absolute
ridiculous
bunk. Absolute bunk. Yeah.
I mean, it's of all the new paradigm perspectives, it's the one that is most immediately worthy of rejection and even scorn.
Not really, though. All right, Richard, listen to me. I've been studying it for about 30 years because I've been on the radio as a talk show host, and I can tell you without reservation, without question, that when there is a full moon, Richard, the calls get dramatically different when you're sitting taking calls just from the general public about whatever. They get dramatically different. I mean, agitation levels are through the roof. People get sort of a little bit manic. There is, without question, anybody who works in a hospital can tell you what I'm saying is true. So there's no question about it. When the moon is full, it affects human beings, period.
Yes. And that's probably the most well-known
effect
that many people are recognize in their everyday life, and I think we all tend to feel it in our own our own monthly experience.
Absolutely. So astrology is nothing more than an extension of that. If one affects you, and I think most people believe it's true, then the others, to perhaps a different extent or in a different way, also affect you, and that is astrology.
That's right, that there's a correspondence between the movements of the planets and the sun and moon and human experience. I mean, that's the basic thesis. But the kind of evidence that there's many people doing very serious research in this area, even though it's not studied, with few exceptions, it's not studied and taught in the university. Though that's changing.
Is it changing?
Yes, there's several quite good programs that have emerged that in England at Bath Spa University in Bath, England.
Really?
There's a program there, and here in the United States, I and Stanislav Grof have been teaching courses in this at the California Institute of Integral Studies, as well as at Pacifica. There's also a Kepler College in Seattle, Washington, that has built a whole kind of classic Renaissance.
So what's old
liberal
is
liberal education that's centered on astrology, much as it. As it was.
Uh-huh. So what's old is new. In other words, it's back in vogue to be studied. I've been to the Vatican, and I remember walking in a very important building and at the Vatican and seeing this giant monster globe that was divided into the signs of the zodiac, Richard, and it stopped me in my tracks. I went, my God, I'm in the Vatican, and here are the astrological signs on a giant globe. And it just hit me like a rock.
Hmm.
So it's always been with us, hasn't it?
That's right. And it was actually taught in the medieval Catholic universities as an essential part of the, usually the medical faculty was the one that was teaching it. And then definitely in the Renaissance, of course, it just saturated the artistic sensibility at that time. So you're right. It's always been with us in one form or another. And the emperors and the popes always had their astrologers. But I think the question as to whether the planets rule us is a fundamental one, because the issue of determinism or fatalism, where somehow where the planets are when we're born, fundamentally rules our existence in a way that we're unable to, you know, do anything about, or the idea that where the planets are at any given time affects me or affects the world in such a way that we're sort of helpless puppets.
Yes. Yeah. Do you don't believe that?
That's right. And I think actually a sound knowledge of the correlations of, like, knowing what kinds of things tend to happen under what kinds of planetary alignments actually is a liberating rather than an imprisoning or constraining.
All right, we're at a break point here. We have to break,
okay.
Richard. So hold on right there. So I think we've established, Richard believes that there is an effect by the moon most strongly, and then by the planets to a lesser or different degree. And so I wonder, Richard, whether you think that is it too simplistic to say that free will does trump what the planets otherwise might have in store for you, or bends it a little or something, but doesn't eliminate it?
Right, it doesn't eliminate it. And I think that thinking in terms of the one trumping the other, that reflects more looking at it as a zero-sum game. In other words, as if the planets are affecting us. By the way, when I say planets affecting us, I don't believe that the planets have a causal relationship to, you know, our experience. I think rather they are more like signs. In the same way with a clock, the clock doesn't make it. When the hands of the clock are at the place where it says it's 11:30, the clock is not causing it to be 11:30. It's reflecting the fact that it's 11:30.
Right.
And it's the same way with the planets. The planets seem to be, I think it's more, that's a kind of outmoded way of looking at it, that the planets are causing the patterns of human experience that we notice coincide with the planetary movements. Rather, they, I believe, are signs of them. They are symbols of what's happening. Now, to think in terms of the planets, the planetary influences, let's call them, I think the influences are coming from a kind of archetypal level of the deep consciousness and unconscious, what Jung called the collective unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, Art, when you say, does free will trump the planets?
Yes.
I think that presumes that it's one or the other, or it's a kind of wrestling match between them. But if one instead looks upon these archetypal forces, to use a Jungian frame of reference, it's more like the human being can play a more or less conscious role in participating in how they are expressed.
Well, let me drag it down probably a little bit by saying this. I'm a Gemini, Richard, and I've read several good books that describe the general traits and personality aspects that can be expected of a Gemini. And I must say that the general truths listed for a Gemini, traits and so forth, seem incredibly convincing. In other words, when I read my sun sign characteristics, it nails me to a T.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that does seem like a strong force. I mean, it seems like a strong, established truth of some kind.
That's
it doesn't
right.
mean
no.
it doesn't dictate any specific behavior at any specific time, but
right.
darn, it seems real.
Yes. No, I'm not in any way doubting its reality. What I'm rather saying, see, I think where the resistance, and I think it's a healthy resistance, to astrology as being deterministic doesn't come from something like that, where you recognize, certain, personality characteristics and the fact that you're a Gemini. Rather, it comes from a sense that I have no choice in how I'm going to express, in this case, let's say, that the range of ways in which a Gemini could express itself. Let me, I happen to look up your birth chart since your birth date
oh,
is on the...
did you now?
Yeah, it was on the internet, on the Wikipedia, and...
Well, I'll be darned.
And so, in looking at that, I was able to see that your Sun and Mercury, which are in conjunction in Gemini...
You've got it.
which has to be probably the position that is most at home with being able to speak for several hours an evening before millions of people.
Yes.
but in addition... both the Sun and Mercury are in a conjunction, a triple conjunction in your chart with the planet Uranus. It's a few degrees over to the side, but the three of them are all together in Gemini.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the most powerful set of correlations in all our evidence in these years that we've been studying this, it shows that the planet Uranus seems to be correlated with a principle of freedom, of rebelliousness, restlessness, a certain almost sometimes even a kind of brilliance of innovation, a desire to break out of orthodoxies of any kind. When a person has a sun Uranus conjunction just by itself, this tends to be a real rebel, from the and it can express itself anywhere from being a juvenile delinquent to being a rebellious scientist like Galileo, who also had the sun Uranus.
Yes.
So
yes. Well, anyway, look, these things do seem to be, I guess it's self-evident. I'll say self-evident. I cop to everything just about that it says about a Gemini. So that seems, on the face of it, Richard, to be an incredibly strong force. Now, maybe we can modify our behavior at the macro or even micro level, but at the end of the day, it kind of nails you down. That is to say, where the planets and everything were at the moment or the instant of your birth. It seems to be an extremely powerful force, and Western culture and science is in complete denial about it.
Yes, I think much in line with a lot of the other themes that you treat in this show, there are certain areas of evidence and research that are just so threatening to the orthodox worldview that is maintained by our kind of cultural high priest, so to speak. That
it, you used the right word, threatening, by the way.
Yeah, and when something is genuinely threatening, then that's when the greater amount of ridicule and resistance is activated, because they can tell something, there's a strong sense of threat.
Ridicule has been part of my life, Richard. I live with it, and I know about it. I don't give a damn. How about that? I don't.
How did you manage to forge such a indifference to it?
I'm not sure. I guess 20 or 30 years of exploring areas that people considered either ridiculous or dangerous or I don't know, a whole variety of things. I mean, it's just been tossed at me so much that I've formed a force field around myself. And I expect ridicule. It's part of what I do. I don't care.
That's very admirable.
I don't know if it's admirable. I just don't care anymore. I'm going to explore the areas that I wish to explore, whether anybody likes it or not. I guess that's a pretty bad attitude, huh?
Well, it seems to me you've managed to come up with sufficient armor that you can make your way through life, so that you're doing what you're.
Yeah, in other words, the armor was necessary, Richard.
Yeah, yeah, no, I can believe it.
Yes. So, how then should we? What should our attitude be about this knowledge that, we're kind of what we are, and yes, we can move around within that realm, but not all that far from it, really?
Well, I see it a little bit differently. First of all, I think recognizing that there is a relationship between, my experience and who I am and where the planets were when I was born and where they continue to go in the course of life in relationship to my chart, that's what's called transits, recognizing that correlation helps me to see that I live in a cosmos that is in some way meaningfully focused on me as an individual and on all human individuals. And also, in some sense, it's focused meaningfully on the Earth. And this gives a whole different sense of that, what we live in is a different universe than the void of meaning that we're taught that we live in. John Mack was a good friend of mine. I know John.
Oh, I interviewed John many, many times.
Yes, and that was one of the reasons why when I was asked to come onto your show, and I remember John talking to me about your show, and we had many discussions, and he's about these issues, and one of the ways in which he saw a commonality between our work was that as he put it, both of us were in the business of blowing the Western mind, as he put it.
Blowing the Western mind, yes, indeed. By the way, what did you think of his work?
Well, I thought it was very courageous. He was an extremely sympathetic. He was a person who had a deep heart, and he listened to people who were telling stories and sharing their experiences that were just outside the bounds of what was allowed to be possible for, any other psychotherapist, and he had the courage and the compassion to listen to them.
He did,
and he also not only treated them as worthy of being listened to, but he also let their messages somehow transform his sense of what the universe was about. I mean,
put another way, Richard, he bought it. You believe he bought it, right?
I do, yes.
Yeah, so do I.
He had too many people telling him that they'd had, telling him such similar stories, and they'd had no common, connection before they were reporting these experiences. Now, I think in terms of his effectiveness in the world, he might have been a little bit more effective had he been able to maintain a slightly more distanced or slightly less obvious, if he didn't seem to have bought it quite so obviously, I think he might have been more effective, and I think that's where...
Yeah, but he'd have been less honest. Look, he bought it. He believed what he heard, and so I'm kind of with him on this. I understand that you're saying in the real world, perhaps he would have achieved more credibility by seeming to keep more distance, but that would be sort of intellectually dishonest, right?
Well, there's two ways of doing it. One is I'm not suggesting that he would say anything that he didn't believe, but I'm saying that if he...
He was too passionate for you, huh?
Well, not for me.
Not for you.
No,
but remember,
we both came out of Harvard, and yes. I watched what happened to him at Harvard, and he suffered, you know, basically a kind of star court.
He did.
And in order to, I think, you know, when he began his work, he used the phrase, when he began his work with the abductees.
Yes.
He said, this is an authentic mystery. He said, we don't, you know, they bear all the symptoms of having actually had these experiences. So something is going on, and what it is, we don't know.
Right.
But something is going on, and these people bear listening to with very seriously. So I think that starting point was very effective, and I remember that when he used that phrase, it was even published in the, you know, in the Harvard.
But can't you understand, Richard, how that for a researcher like him, when it passed the bar of whatever skeptical entry he made into it all, when it really passed that bar and he became convinced that this is really going on, then I don't know. I guess I can understand the kind of passion.
Yes. No, I can fully... I mean, basically, I've gone through the exactly parallel situation with my own research in a similarly controversial area, and I too have come to be convinced of something that I am now passionately willing to put myself behind, you know.
Yes, but as I listen to you, I hear great caution in much of what you say, and so your survival in the academic community, I think, is much more sure than his was, right?
Well, that's to be determined.
you mean there may be trouble ahead, Richard?
Well, I'm not worried about. I mean, he was teaching at Harvard, and that was a more difficult situation to be in. I'm in the West Coast with a more liberal surroundings and people. I mean, my classes in this
area.
Yeah,
but they're listening to you all over the country, though. Right now, for example.
Sure, but they can't fire me. Anyway, my main point is that I fully sympathize with why John became so passionate about it. I think that he might have just been a little bit more measured in that one book in particular, Abduction. I think that was probably the one that...
A little more circumspect.
Yeah, a little bit more would have been more... effective or politic, but that was John, and one of the things that made John a great man is that he fully went into whether it was, you know, anti-nuclear activism,
yes,
the work that he did, even as a biographer of D.H. Lawrence when he won the Pulitzer Prize.
Well, Richard, what made him effective on this program was that he was so damn passionate about the whole thing. It had passed that bar. It was obvious that he believed there was a real phenomena going on here. I mean, it came through loud and clear. So that made him a real hit with radio audiences.
Yes.
For good cause.
Yep. Well, the reason I brought up John was that both John Mack and I were convinced that the belief that is so, you know, widespread in the modern scientific community, that human consciousness is the only consciousness around, is a delusion, and that it's and that in fact there is forms of intelligence that transcend the human, that are around the human, that the cosmos itself seems to be informed by it and an intelligence. And the form it took for him was especially through the conviction that of the existence of extraterrestrial intelligence. But he also was, you know, very much into the research that I was doing as well. We often discussed his, you know, birth chart and transits and the other astrological research that I'd been doing.
Was he able to convince you that there was an extraterrestrial presence, and that is what was being experienced? Did you become convinced of that yourself?
Yes, I was. I'd read enough of that kind of material beforehand, and that I didn't have any strong resistance to it. So when he started telling me about it, I felt that this was something that it wasn't a shock. In fact, it was more of a shock for him than it was for me when he first was entering into it.